This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. You can now watch our TV show on Free Speech TV every weekday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern. FSTV is on Dish Network, DirecTV, and Roku. The Donald Trump phenomenon is an undeniable part of the American political landscape today, no matter how badly liberals and progressives wish it away. There are multiple and complex reasons for this, but regardless, it's here to stay, meaning that even if Hillary Clinton wins in November, we as a country have to understand and deal with the fact that millions of Americans have pledged allegiance to a man considered to be incredibly racist, sexist, nationalist, and highly flawed. Today, we explore the notion that it might be possible for people who completely disagree over Trump to actually talk to one another. My guest is Sharon Ellison. She is the creator of the powerful non-defensive communication process, and she's written the book Taking the War Out of Our Words. She has done many, many workshops in many professional settings, and she actually came to us as a recommendation from a listener. Welcome to the program, Sharon.
Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for joining us. Thank you. So it's something that is not something we deal, progressives in particular, think about or deal with often enough. We want to win over the undecideds, but it's those who are firmly in the right part of the political spectrum that we write off. You know, I'm not going to try to convince the person who watches Fox News every day because they're just never going to agree with me anyway, so I'm not going to bother. But today we have a presidential campaign where somebody who's so far right-wing has attracted so many people that I don't think it makes sense for us to simply write off that many Americans anymore. So let's get started about how it is that we do talk to one another, and as your process suggests, what tends to get in our way is defensiveness. We tend to, when we talk to people we disagree with, get very defensive. So why is that? Why do people get super defensive when talking to other people that they disagree with?
Well, first of all, I think you made a beautiful delineation when you said we either give up or we try to convince. And and I recently was looking up some information about the art of persuasion. And the word persuasion means to coax, to almost to threaten, to manipulate. And other definitions are potency and power. And the antonyms for persuasion are actually weakness and impotence and failure. And so we come from a long history of being taught that the art of persuasion is incredibly important in our lives. And it means that you're masterful, but what you're masterful at is manipulating other people. So when we try to convince each other, then that pushes the defensive mechanism in the brain. And what we know now, and that's essentially a lot of what political debate is. So when people are debating, it's essentially an argument. So they take turns blaming and defending. And when you do that, what's going to happen is anyone who is witnessing this interaction, and in this case, it's millions, even billions of people, not just in the U.S., but across the world. And then you have a he said, she said kind of dynamic going on. And as soon as people get defensive, scientists like Dr. Joseph Ledoux have now shown that it doesn't even take a nanosecond, but the second you feel a need to protect yourself, all of the neurons in the brain go flying past the complex problem-solving part of the brain, and they land smack dab in fight or flight. Once that happens, you have no ability to think. So this whole idea that we can present the other person with the facts of a situation is not going to work as long as there's an ounce of convincing going on. And then the second thing that happens, I think, is that people who are committed to justice and compassion and principles of democracy about inclusiveness, I think often we don't realize that we are as much a part of the power struggle as the people we may be reacting to who we see as being divisive or, as you say, you know, racist, anti-Semitic, misogynist, all of those things. And there's a man named Dawson, and I took a workshop with him one time, and he was talking about how they condition soldiers to be willing to kill. And he used a phrase that I love. I mean, I hate it, but I love it, which is the superior victim attacker. So many times people who are working toward peace or toward justice often feel like they may be in the underdog position, and so they're fighting. But it's like comedian Carlin said when he said, fighting for peace is like screwing for virginity. I mean, it's such a profound way to say that it simply doesn't work. And so what's happening is, we all know that defensiveness is hardwired, and so we just kind of expect that people are going to get defensive, and we can't do anything about it. But we haven't developed other skill sets, and we have an immense amount of information now that gives us more power to create change in a way that does truly help to allow people to even listen to each other. And Ledoux and others are saying that while you can't talk someone out of being defensive, and what that means is, yes, when we go out to try to convince someone, we might as well quit, because we're only going to help entrench them in their position. But he said, if you can talk to people in a way where, not by manipulating or controlling, but if how I talk to you does something to allow you to move out of defensive posture into any other kind of feeling, then it's like you're talking to a completely different person. And what I've done in my work is I've gone back and I have changed four fairly simple aspects of how we communicate: our intention, our voice tone, our body language, and some aspects of phrasing. And they seem to make people feel safe. And so what we haven't really understood, because we all know if you get defensive, then how long does it take that adrenaline to go away? You know, at least.
Right. And also, if you get defensive, you're basically given up on, then it's just a matter of winning the fight, not actually making any headway.
That's right. And we expect that once we get defensive, it has to last. But the fact is, and here's my example that everybody really can identify with. Have you ever been really defensive and someone, just the right person, says something very funny and you burst out laughing, and all of that residue of defensiveness is gone instantly? And the four things I've changed in the communication process actually have that impact. And if you want, I can give you an example of how you might say something in a way that would cause the defensiveness versus how you could say it in a way that kind of diffuses it. And then when it prompts the other person to think, then all of a sudden it changes the whole reality.
And definitely I'd like for you to sort of give us some examples. But recently there was this Washington Post article entitled, "Finally, Someone Who Thinks Like Me," in quotes, about a woman named Melanie Austin. And this has been really making the rounds of social media, because this article, rather than caricaturizing Trump supporters, attempted to try to see what it was about their, you know, perspectives that led them to back him in the first place. And a lot of it is simply people feeling left behind. And it's not necessarily that Trump is the best candidate out there. He might really sort of be the only candidate out there that people feel strikes this chord in them. So it's really interesting to see that. And I'm wondering, tomorrow, if I were to meet this woman, Melanie Austin, or somebody like her, anybody like her who supports Trump, how would I change my, I think it was, you said, change my intention and the tone of voice and stuff to talk to her? What, can you give us some examples of the kinds of things I could say to a Trump supporter to not try to get into an argument, but to try to genuinely understand where it is they're coming from?
So first of all, I think we have to look at our intention. If I walk into any situation with judgment in my mind and my heart, the other person is going to sense it. And so the first thing I have to do is to start with pure curiosity. And when I start with curiosity, even the way we've learned to ask questions has been modeled after interrogation. So if you asked a Trump supporter, somebody that okay, you're a Democrat and you want to vote for Hillary and you are offended by some of the things that are going on in the Trump campaign, and you say, well, what draws you to Trump? Okay. Now, can you see how I'm shaking my head and frowning? And my voice is coming up at the end of my question. So I'm already conveying, and people are not aware of the degree to which they do this. I can get people up in front of any audience and have them practice. And I call it the defensive shimmy. People frown, they shake their head. And you know, the old root word for question is things like interrogation and even torture during a trial. So we have generations, history, centuries of asking questions, coming up, leaning forward, frowning, shaking our head. But if I were instead going to come from a place of curiosity and ask the simplest of questions, and if you'll notice, I'm going to come down at the end of the question instead of the up. And this time, instead of saying, what is it that draws you to Trump? I'm going to say, what is it that draws you to Trump? Can you feel the difference there, Sonali?
Right. So just the kind of, almost you've taken judgment out of your words. It's more flat.
Yes, and it's not quite flat. It has rhythm. You know, it's not robotic. People often tend to think of it because we're so used to pushing the energy. But it kind of starts here, it has a little bit of rhythm and it comes down. Hmm. So I might say, what is it that drew you to Trump?
Curiosity more than judgment.
Yes, I have to start with curiosity. The whole goal here is I'm not going to try to manipulate or control you. I'm going to ask questions that are sincere, that can draw you out, and then I'm going to make a statement or make a prediction. And so I might ask the question, did you see the clip of the video where he mocked a disabled reporter? Hmm. And when you saw that, how did you react?
I see.
If you saw your child doing something like that, would you feel good about it or bad about it? What would you do? How would you respond?
And you think that putting the questions in those way wouldn't make a Trump supporter defensive or would be less likely to?
No, what's really amazing about this process is that, I mean, it doesn't mean they couldn't get defensive, mm-hmm. but what's truly amazing about it is when you change that voice tone, what happens is the need for the defense disappears. And then at an almost autonomic level, I mean, I have amazing stories, like a man in a hotel who was totally rude to me about a bunch of noise. And he was like, what do you want? Have your money back. And I said to him, what's making you angry at me when I'm the person that was inconvenienced? Hmm. Now, if I said, why are you angry at me when I'm the one that was inconvenienced? It would have just increased, you know, accelerated the conflict. But when all I did was ask a very direct question and come down at the end, and he stopped dead cold and he looked off into space and he went, you know, I really need to get a better way for the maids to communicate because they have to shout back and forth between the, would you like half your money back? I mean, yeah, it's like, it's amazing.
So this technique can come in really handy when people are calling customer service lines, for example, yeah. or tech support. But I want to sort of step back and ask you, I mean, so Sharon, somebody like me, a brown-skinned woman with an immigrant background and a foreign-sounding name, you know, my immediate instinct when I see, for example, a older white Trump supporter is, in my mind, that person is already judged me, because if they back a person who say ban all Muslims, if they back a person who is so overtly racist and encouraging racism, you know, he has KKK and Confederate flag wavers among his supporters, it's asking a lot from somebody like me to approach a Trump supporter with no judgment. I mean, I'm basically going to have to engage in some performance art.
yes, but also we can make statements, you know, like I could say to someone, if I were in your position with your background, your name, I might say to a Trump supporter, is there a way that I can talk to you without you seeing me as someone that should be sent away from this country? Hmm. And so there's a way in which when we get defensive, we're actually giving our power over to the other. I do a role play. I was called into a school where there'd been a gang murder, and I trained 450 freshmen in 2 days. And I got up in front of the class and I told the kids, okay, you know, I'm going to disband the rules on name calling. And I want you to call, I'd call someone up and I'd say, call me a name. And while you do, put out your hand like a hook. And that, you know, that person would go, you bitch or something. And then I would point at their, and I wouldn't take the hand. And I'd say, hold it out like a claw. And then I ask the kids in the room, who a lot of who have really learned you've got to save face. And I say, if I take that hook, who has the power, her or me, or him or me? And they instantly get it. And so when I can ask a good non-defensive question, one of the questions I would ask about immigrants is, so someone saying, well, we need to get rid of the immigrants and we know, you know, they're violent. And I might say, are you aware that more about half of the people who are working hard in our fields to put the food on our tables are undocumented immigrants? What do you think would happen to all of us if the people here who are immigrants, who are willing to take jobs that many of us and even our children wouldn't take, were suddenly all sent away.
So, I mean, I don't know. I feel like a Trump supporter, and maybe this is my own bias. I would feel like a Trump supporter would simply spit out something offensive to even that. But that's my, you know, sort of preconceived notion based on what I'm reading and what I see about Trump supporters. But I have to confess, I've never actually face-to-face talked to somebody who was actively backing Trump, standing, you know, within each other's personal space. I've never done that.
So the first thing to me that's important is when I'm communicating non-defensively is that I'm doing it with my own character. Maybe the person feels like they still need to argue back with you. Maybe there's someone else standing and watching. Hmm. And what happens is when we get into power struggle, we go to the lowest common denominator. And at that moment, then we start either withdrawing or fighting back. But if we hold our own presence with a kind of wisdom, I think this is one of the reasons that President Obama was able to turn red states blue, because he had a way of speaking that was not defensive. And I can't emphasize enough the fact that when people drop their defenses, it's like suddenly you can go, it may reach their heart. You may not see it in the moment. And if I don't try to convince you, then what ends up happening is the defensive mechanism isn't in play. So when you walk away, many people say to me over and over as they work with this kind of non-defensive process, they'll say over and over, wow, the non-defensive question makes the other person really stop and think. Hmm.
So in other words, if one wanted to say flip a Donald Trump supporter, as a recent Alternet article suggested that you were featured in, then one would really have to go in without wanting to, or, you know, having the intention to not do so and simply being curious.
Yes, yes. And actually, I didn't have any control over how the title was picked, but the whole idea of flipping, really, if you wanted to flip a Trump supporter, then you would have to actually not try to flip them.
Right.
But there's a way in which when I'm saying what I see, if I just tell you what I see, rather than trying to convince you that your kid wouldn't walk out into that damn field and pick those berries, oh, what do you mean my kid wouldn't? My kid's good. My kid's strong. They would do it. You know, now we've got the power struggle going on. But if I speak subjectively, what I see is that the many of these millions of these of the immigrants here are doing work that I don't believe that my children would do, that I wouldn't do. But when you're talking about the people that you are bringing into the country, the millions of people who are cleaning our houses and planting our fields and harvesting our food, then it seems to me that Americans, we are blaming people who are actually doing amazing work to support us.
Hmm. I mean, you know, maybe this is demanding too much, but what I really want from a Trump supporter is anti-immigrant isn't to just say, thank goodness there are poor, vulnerable people picking our crops. What I want them to do is acknowledge the humanity that these people are real human beings. And it seems like such a basic thing to want people to do, just understand that these are human beings. Muslims are human beings. Undocumented people are human beings. Women are human beings. Treat other human beings the way you would like to be treated. Why? I mean, you know, again, so maybe even talking to you about this is making me defensive, but it upsets me to think that our standard for, you know, voters is so low that we can safely assume that we have to, you know, that we can't expect these folks to think of immigrants as human beings. I mean, they're human beings.
Yes. And you know what? You can say every single thing you're saying. The only difference is when you get the urgency to try to convince, that's what makes a difference. And I did something I never should have done. I was focused on the fact that we are unappreciative. And I can say, I think Americans are not appreciating the level of gift that people coming to this country are giving us. But what I did was I focused on the immigrants who were coming in and working in the fields, and I should not have focused so wholly on that, because there are many, many immigrants coming to this country who are bringing brilliant scientific minds and compassion, and who are coming with more education than half of us in this country have. So I apologize for saying that in a way that, but what I want to say is, for us to be able to call upon ourselves, and this is how I would say it. I can say it makes me angry sometimes. It makes me feel wounded sometimes, and what is really hard for me is that somehow as Americans, whether we have come from privilege or not come from privilege, that somehow we are looking at other people's contributions in this country and taking it for granted as if we're the privileged and they're not, and then we're blaming them for causing our problems. And we do that in a lot of levels. More Americans are killed by other Americans than by immigrants, and yet we're blaming the immigrants.
More Americans are killed by toddlers with guns than terrorists. I mean, yeah, there's so many stats. But then we get into the messy world of statistics too, right? I mean, if you only watch Fox News, you get fed a steady diet of very misleading facts that make you almost immune to things that are really facts. And when you stop to talk to somebody who might have a completely different set of facts, it's how do you bridge that gap?
Well, and that's why I speak subjectively. So I tell the person what I've seen, and what I want to say is, for me, I think one of the things that is a challenge for us all as Americans right now is to be able to appreciate the incredible work that people who are immigrants have done for us, instead of blaming them for all our problems. To me, we need to strengthen our own character as human beings and be able to see the humanity of other people, or we're not ever going to be happy. We're always going to be walking around with our cup half full and blaming other people. Now, I can say that with passion, but if I say, look, we're the ones who aren't appreciating the gifts that we're getting from other people, as soon as I get that urgency, I'm trying to convince you, and the neurons in your brain are going to go straight to fight or flight. I have one really simple example that maybe could show the difference in impact. That was about, do you remember when people were accusing Obama of being elitist because he was went to an Ivy League university?
Right, and there was this whole thing around, what was it, some vegetable, was it kale or?
I don't know.
Arugula, it was arugula. Right, yes, I do remember that.
And so people were using that, people on the right were using that to try to convince working class people that they couldn't identify with Obama. But nobody just came out and quietly said, do you think that it's more elitist that Obama went to an Ivy League school than it is that Bush went to one?
Right.
Now you're doing, you see, you're exposing it, but you're not doing it as a fight. Hey, Bush went to an Ivy League school too. What are you talking about?
So you ask people their opinion.
That's I'm doing it. Yeah. And here's the ad that I created in my mind at the time that they were accusing him. And people can fight back. You can say he's not elitist. You know, I mean, he went to work and in community building after he graduated. No matter how you argue, you are going to, I mean, I think for me, Sonali, this is the key, is if you, our goal, I believe that defensiveness is the greatest glass ceiling on our human potential as individuals, as a whole global community. And I believe that power struggle is the most pervasive and least recognized addiction on earth. Once we're in it, it's hard to get out of it.
Right.
But so here's the little ad that I did, when instead of going back and trying to argue against, if you counter the other person's point, the odds are 99.9% in my mind that you will prompt the defensiveness and that person cannot think rationally, can't hear data. When you do it in a way that the defenses are gone, then people can take in information in a different way. So here was the ad I did. I said, Barack Obama was raised by a single mom. He went to college on a scholarship, and he took a job after graduating where he could give back to community. Is that elitism, or is that the American dream?
Well, Sharon, it sounds like the Democrats should be having you consult with them during this election. Give out a website where people can find out more information, because we are out of time.
Yes, my website is www.p as in Paul, n as in Nancy, d as in David, CasinConnie.com. It stands for Powerful Non-Defensive Communication. If you even look up the word non-defensive on the internet, my site pops up a lot. And secondly, if you go to the word learning on the drop-down menu, there's everything from YouTube, cuts from my CDs, live interviews, many stories from people that have used the process. So there's a lot of free learning on the website.
Right, yeah, lots of downloads, etc. That's PNDC.com. I want to thank you so much, Sharon, for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
My guest is Sharon Ellison. She's the creator of the Powerful Non-Defensive Communication Process. She's written the book, Taking the War Out of Our Words. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can sign up for our newsletter at risingupwithsonali.com to get daily emails with links to all our stories.